We're back with Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Brian Bello. Today on the show, we're focusing in on the secession crisis that gripped the nation 150 years ago this spring. When we left off, it was February 1861, and representatives from the seven lower South states that had left the Union were meeting in Montgomery to create a new government.
At the same time in Springfield, Illinois, President-elect Abraham Lincoln was boarding a train for Washington, D.C. It had been three whole months since his election, and would be another month still before he would actually take office. And so you can imagine the anticipation all along his route as people gathered in the hopes of hearing something, anything really, about what the man whose election had triggered the crisis planned to do about it. Radio producer Thomas Pierce is going to tell the story now of Lincoln's journey to the White House.
We begin in a baggage car. Trunks full of books and clothes rattle as a train moves east. On a small card, the trunk's owner and destination, A. Lincoln, White House, Washington, D.C. The ride is just as bumpy up in the passenger car. Reporters grumble how it's hard to write down anything at all. They are here to document the two-week journey of the president-elect, who watches tiny Illinois prairie towns pass by outside the window. The stop at each train depot is a similar scene. Brass bands that erupt into old songs like Hail Columbia, church bells, and cannon salutes thousands of people pressing for a first glimpse of their new president.
He has a large head with a very high shelving forehead.
One reporter writes,
a first crop of darkish whiskers, a clean, well-built neck, more back than chest, a long, lank trunk.
Future President Rutherford B. Hayes, who's in the audience in Indianapolis, notes Lincoln's curious way of bowing uncomfortably to the crowds.
His chin rises, his body breaks in two at the hip. Homely as L is, if you get a good view of him by daylight, when he is talking, he is by no means ill-looking.
In town after town, Lincoln addresses the crowds from podiums in the back of the train, and at least once standing on a chair in a hotel lobby. At each of these stops, he seems to make a point of not really saying much at all.
You know that it has not been my custom, since I started on this route to Washington, to make long speeches. I am rather inclined to silence, and whether that be wise or not, it is at least more unusual nowadays to find a man who can hold his tongue than to find one who cannot.
In the months after his election, Lincoln had proved he was a man who could hold his tongue, especially on the subject the public most wanted to hear about, how he planned to handle the fact that state after state was leaving the Union. Many thought his silence was a terrible mistake. One New York Herald editorial called it foolish. The New York Times said the silence had left the field open for a struggle of factions. Alexander Stevens, who would become vice president of the Confederacy, was at the time still arguing against secession in his home state of Georgia. He wrote Lincoln, pleading with him to say something that could help his cause.
A word fitly spoken by you now would indeed be like apples of gold in pictures of silver.
What could Lincoln say that could change the basic problem, which is the South thought slavery was right and Lincoln and the Republicans thought slavery was wrong?
Eric Foner is a professor of history at Columbia University and the author of The Fiery Trial, a book about Lincoln and slavery. He says that while Lincoln appeared to be letting history unfold without him in those months, he was anything but silent behind the scenes.
Lincoln intervenes fairly forcefully by the end of December in letters to members of Congress, in which he makes it very clear that he is opposed to compromise on what he considers the key issue, which is the westward expansion of slavery.
Let there be no compromise on the issue of extending slavery,
he wrote to Republican allies in Washington.
Have none of it. Stand firm. The tug has to come, and better now than at any time hereafter.
In Congress, which was starting to thin out with defections, there were increasingly desperate calls for a plan that might head off military action. Kentucky Senator John Crittenden was proposing that the Constitution be amended to protect slavery forever where it already existed, and that the Missouri Compromise be reinstated, allowing for the extension of slavery below a certain line. Lincoln didn't take issue with the constitutional amendment, but he was dead set against any plan that would result in the creation of even a single new slave state.
Lincoln says, basically, look, we've been elected on this platform. If we compromise now, a year from now, they're going to threaten to secede unless we acquire Cuba as a slave state. In one of his letters to a member of Congress, he says, you know, if we compromise, it's the end of us as a party.
In the end, all five Republicans on the Senate committee considering the Crittenden plan voted against it. And the Republican Party, of course, lived long and prospered. But the fact that Lincoln proved savvy in his political calculations that winter does not mean he had any idea of what was just around the corner.
The great danger here is reading history backwards. The alternative to compromise was not necessarily war. I think Lincoln and many Republicans believed that if they just waited the crisis out, if they delayed, that secession would sort of collapse from within. Lincoln was willing to risk war, but I don't think he saw war as the inevitable outcome of not compromising.
And so as Lincoln boarded the train in Springfield on that chilly February morning, 1861, a gray shawl wrapped around his shoulders, really there were no inevitables. Lincoln had drawn his line in the sand, but nobody, including Lincoln himself, knew what might happen next.
That special report for Backstory is from radio producer Thomas Pierce.
So, Ed, Peter, we've talked about how a lot of the secessionists thought, you know, the North was just going to let the South go, that there really wasn't going to be a war over this. Can we read Lincoln's silences, given him trying to hold his party together and everything, his refusal to compromise? Can we read that as Lincoln thinking, yeah, the South really isn't going to fight, that this secession thing is just going to fall apart if we don't fan the flames?
Yeah, Brian, that's a plausible interpretation. Lincoln just didn't get how deep secessionist feeling was in the South. He thought it could be isolated, that it was a kind of a cancer that could be excised.
And he has good reason to think that, because a lot of people from the Upper South are telling him that.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
right.
Mr. President, if you'll just be patient, we'll work it out down here, especially in Virginia.
And think about this, Ed. Virginia is right at the center of the Union, or at least historically.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's the absolute heart and soul of the United States of America. And a lot of these border state people, they take all this manifest destiny talk and they say, our future is with this great imperial republic.
Yeah, the border states say we're virtually a third nation.
That's right.
Okay, are the reasonable people. The weirdo abolitionists in New England and the weirdo secessionists in South Carolina, they're not the real America. We are, and we'll figure this out.
And that's when slavery comes in, though, because that becomes the issue, doesn't it, Ed?
Yeah, well, because here's the fundamental paradox. Virginia is the great compromiser, the great mother of presidents, and also the largest slave state.
Right.
Not merely in the number of enslaved people who live there, but in its centrality in the slave trade.
Yeah, they depended on the rest of the South. That was a big market their human property.
Matter of fact, if you don't have that market, you worry about being overrun by enslaved people.
Exactly.
So Virginia is deeply tied to the Deep South.
And so on February 13th, at the very same time that the Confederacy is drawing up its new constitution, a group of white men gather in Richmond to try and figure out what Virginia should do. They've been sent there by Virginia voters, and when they arrive, only one out of six delegates is actually in favor of secession. Here's Civil War historian William Freeling, who's just published a book about the convention.
The Virginia Convention is often called the Virginia Secession Convention, but if you look at all its deliberations till they finally decide on April 17th, it's better to call it a Unionist Convention, because what most of the deliberations are trying to do is find some way to save the Union. Their dream is to get the Lower South to come back into the Union, so they don't want to alienate it too much. They're classic men in the middle who are trying desperately to keep the extremes from going to war with each other.
Just like their counterparts further south, most of these guys make the case that slavery would be safest inside the Union. But Virginia, they argue, has more at stake than anybody.
I say, sir, that a dissolution of the Union will be the commencement of the abolition of slavery. Will it not, sir, make a hostile border for Virginia and enable slaves to escape more rapidly, because more securely? Will it not virtually bring Canada to our doors?
By Virginia's seceding, you transfer the seat of this war to this fertile and salubrious country. Virginia would be the battleground. Her fields would be laid waste.
Will you bring this desolation upon us? Will you make northwestern Virginia the Flanders of America and convert our smiling valleys into the slaughter pens of as brave and loyal a people as dwell in the old Dominion? I hope not.
So how did secessionists counter this prediction that secession would bring devastation to Virginia? They said, if it's peace you're after, the best thing we can do is secede.
We are told that it will bring war. On the contrary, it will tend to avert war. Virginia, united with the Southern Confederacy, will present small inducement for war upon that Confederacy.
And that's what the secessionists keep saying. The issue is not, should we ideally secede? The issue is, we've already got a secession. The question is now, should we stay in the Union when a third of the South has gone out of the Union? Now, that's a fascinating position, because it indicates how much those first third Southerners who went out of the Union can manipulate and control the other Southerners.
And what do you think the key point of leverage was for those states that went out? Was it the importance of those states to the Southern economy, or was it the fact that the remaining Southern states were now a pretty distinct minority in Congress, less able to protect slavery than ever?
That's exactly the point that secessionists make. Maybe we would have been in a position to stay in the Union if everybody had stayed in the Union. But now we are stuck in the Union with only 8 states against 20 northern states, and 4 of our states are kind of shaky. Delaware owns only 1,700 slaves. Maryland has as many free blacks as slaves. What business do we have trying to protect slavery when our great protectors are now in another nation?
That's William Freeling, senior fellow at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. We'll post an excerpt from his latest book on secession, Showdown in Virginia, at backstoryradio.org.
So that's how the debate in Richmond goes for 7 long weeks. While the delegates are inside debating, outside pro-secession demonstrators are building bonfires, marching in the streets, urging what they call the grannies inside to go ahead and act, and to act decisively on behalf of the new nation. Finally, on April 4th, the secessionists force a vote. And result, after all of this, after all the bonfires and parades and speeches, is 2-1 against secession.
Wow.
Okay, and so the country's looking around and going, phew. Okay, boy,
dodged
that was close.
Dodged a few bullets, know? Right.
Exactly. And it seems like maybe history's turned a corner. But history was unfolding elsewhere as well, especially back down in South Carolina at Fort Sumter, a federal outpost in the mouth of Charleston Harbor. Right after Lincoln takes office, he finds out that the Union soldiers in that fort are running out of food, and that without a resupply, they're going to have to leave. They're going to have to pull out. And if they do that, the world's going to say, okay, it looks like South Carolina has actually succeeded in secession. The problem is, if he does send the supplies down there, South Carolina could interpret that as an act of war.
Well, and they do, Ed, because they fire the shots that are heard around the world, you might say, that start the war. And with the shots fired, you might think at last the old fogies in Virginia are going to see the light, and they're going to say, okay, the Rubicon has been crossed. We've got to join our sister states to the South.
You know, you would think that.
Yep.
And yet that's not what happens.
Right.
Virginia does not secede after the firing on Fort Sumter. A lot of people want them to, and they said, no, that's not enough. Sending bread to a fort is not an act of war. But Lincoln looks at this and says, okay, what do we have? We have an explicit attack on the United States. I have no choice as commander-in-chief but to call out the militia across the country to put down this illicit rebellion against federal authority in South Carolina.
Yeah, in fact, Lincoln is calling the secessionists criminals.
Yep.
They're outlaws. They're traitors. And this is an action that all good Americans are going to want to join in, and including Virginians.
And that's when those who had supported Virginia staying in the Union feel that they really have no choice but to go along with secession. They have another vote. This one is the exact opposite of the first vote they'd had. Now the numbers are switched. Ominously, those who vote to stay in the Union are all in the western part of the state, so Virginia is divided. But in the eastern part of Virginia, a great cry goes up that now history has been fulfilled. Virginia's destiny has come to fruition. They are joining the Confederacy.
So both of you seem to think that this is an incredibly important moment, but, you know, it seems to me totally reasonable. If you're going to be in the Union, then you need to supply troops. Why did that simple request for a few troops push Virginia over the edge on this issue?
Well, remember that Virginians had already met to consider the possibility of exiting the Union.
Because they don't deny that secession
That's right.
is legal.
Right, and the very meeting of that convention suggests right. that there is a right to do it. We decided not to do it.
Right.
They exercised that right, and we have more than a scruple about punishing them, about invading a sister state. That's a big taboo in America.
So even if Virginia may not choose to leave, they say South Carolina had the right to.
Yeah, I mean, this is crunch time for Virginians, and they really have to answer the question, where do our ultimate loyalties and interests lie? And if forced to choose, and this whole unionist business is a plea, don't make us choose.
Right.
And what Lincoln does is he forces a choice. You've got to choose.
Or did South Carolina force the choice? And that's precisely what
yeah.
they were trying to do.
Well, I think you could say that. That's
because
right.
otherwise, South Carolina firing on the fort, there was no particular reason they had to do it right then.
Yeah.
Right. But what it does is it means that there can no longer be vacillation in the Upper South.
That's right.
Okay, so now it's a firing war. Which side are you on? And as you say, once Virginia had to decide that, they knew that they would have to stay with their other slave states.
So the real issue, after all this brilliant exegesis, is Virginia's a slave state, and it knows it once the firing begins.
That's right. And so you have a paradox here, Brian, of an unbalanced equation.
Mm-hmm.
The North does not go to war to end slavery, but the South does go to war to protect it.
Absolutely right.
But nobody, Northern or Southern, is imagining that the war will bring this enormously powerful system of slavery to an end in just 4 years.
Sail away. Sail away.
Well, that's it for today's edition of Backstory. In part two of our Civil War series, Why They Fought, we're going to put aside these wonky policy questions, legal interpretations of the Constitution, and we're going to ask why so many men and their families, North and South, were willing to put their lives on the line as the war unfolded.
For more information about that episode, including broadcast times and stations, visit backstoryradio.org. You can also sign up for our free podcast there and listen to any of our past shows. That's backstoryradio.org. Don't be a stranger.
We will cross the mighty ocean into Charleston Bay.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field with help from Catherine Moore. Jamal Milner mastered the show. Gabby Alter wrote our theme.
Special thanks today to the Backstory players, Ray Smith, Kate Burke, Matthew Gibson, Carl Thompson, Ed Barber, Alex Grubbs, Ned Wharton, Burke Hun, Tom Mansbach, Rob Vaughn, Miles Barnes, Coy Barefoot, and Gerald Belisles. Thanks also to Jose Argueta and Miriam Kaplan. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Production support for Backstory is provided by Carrie Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation, James Madison's Montpelier, Marcus and Carol Weinstein, Trish and David Crow, Austin Ligon, and an anonymous donor.
Brian Ballow and Peter Onuf are professors in the University of Virginia's Corcoran Department of History. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond.